Welcome to the Weekly Green, a KXEI mini program on environmental topics from southern Arizona and the rest of the universe. We're joined today by David Stone, who's a project director at the Tohono O'odham Community College, and he has a very remarkable project involving glass.
Recycled glass.
Recycled glass.
And not just any glass, but bottles, beer bottles that are collected by hand across the nation's land. We go to sites where some drinking has been going on, sometimes for decades, and we collect the beer bottles by hand, and we crush them into an aggregate like gravel and sand, and then we use that material as a building material for making blocks and pavers, and now a little structure for storing seeds.
What started this project?
The project started about 8 years ago when I was approached by one of the college administrators, Jane Latine, and she invited me to come out to the college and bring my project with me. She said the college was very interested in green environmental technologies, and they wanted to expose their students to some of this kind of green development because they had not previously had anything like that out there. And so I took her up on it, and I came out and started my project. Which began at the University of Arizona as part of an environmental chemistry degree that I was pursuing there. And the project involved making a new kind of cement. And this iron-based carbon-negative cement was very good, as we found out, at cementing glass particles together, which is not something that Portland cement can do. Glass and Portland cement don't get along with each other, chemically speaking, very well. But this iron-based cement and the glass do very well together. And the iron itself is also a waste product, waste steel dust from shot blasting operations. You've heard of sandblasting. This is steel grit blasting. And eventually the steel grit breaks down into a fine dust. It's of no further value, but it works very well in my project. And we combine that with glass, broken glass bottles, and then nothing happens until we expose that wet concrete-like mix to carbon dioxide gas. And the CO2, which of course is a global warming greenhouse gas, reacts with the iron and forms iron carbonate. And that iron carbonate mineral is what binds the glass together.
You say it's carbon negative. That means that it actually sucks CO2 out of the air.
Even though the CO2 level is rising in the air, we use concentrated sources where the CO2 has been collected and filtered and purified, and we use the CO2 directly out of captured sources. Exhaust streams or beer breweries produce lots of CO2, a very pure CO2. That is captured, and we use it, and it reacts with the iron and then does not escape. It is trapped, or as they say in this environmental technology, it is sequestered. It becomes part of the mineral matrix permanently.
Is it the same process that hardens iron into steel?
No, that's different. It's similar in the sense that carbon is involved. Pure iron is actually quite soft. And to make steel, which of course was a major industrial development, it is combined with pure carbon, graphite or soot in the old days. This is kind of in effect the reverse process. We are now using iron to capture carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and to trap this greenhouse gas. You could say that there is an ironic similarity that in this post-industrial era, we are using iron once again in an environmental way because the process of making iron or steel is highly energetic, produces lots of CO2. In fact, the steelmaking industry is responsible for about 6% of the total global output every year, just making the steel.
And the cement industry, is my understanding, is responsible for about 5% of the total emissions.
Exactly. Between the cement industry and the steel industry, we are already over 10% of the world's total output of carbon dioxide. And that's without even making anything like cars or buildings, which of course produce even more CO2 to drive them and to heat them.
The reason that cement manufacturing has such an enormous carbon footprint is the amount of heat involved to get it to react chemically, which is about 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, I'm told.
Yes, that's right.
And then for the millions and millions of tons of cement produced by year, that's quite a lot of...
Billions, 4 billion tons worldwide, and that equals about 4 billion tons of CO2. For every ton of cement that's manufactured at the plant, about a ton of CO2 is produced, as you say, because of the high heat. Specifically, there are two sources, the burning of fossil fuels, sometimes tens of tons of coal every hour to reduce the limestone to lime, calcium carbonate to calcium oxide, and the resulting byproduct is CO2.
The documentary also says it's 20 tons an hour.
Well, at our local plant here in Marana, yes. And they have won awards from the EPA for reducing that by about 20%. So instead of 1 million tons of CO2 per million tons of cement produced, they have got it down to 800,000 tons, only 800,000 tons. But of course, that's still a lot of CO2.
Back to your cement. You call it ferroc?
We call it ferroc from the words ferro, from the Latin ferrum, meaning iron, and rock, ferroc. So it's iron rock.
How much heat is involved in producing ferroc?
Well, no heat. It is a process that is already very chemically reactive without any added heat. Though I should say that the steel dust or the iron powder that we use as our primary ingredient was produced, industrially speaking, in a process where lots of heat and CO2 production are involved. It is possible to produce iron powder with no heat, electrochemically, just using water and electricity, which could be solar DC for that matter. So there are ways forward in this kind of process to make the entire process in all of its stages greener, from the production of the raw materials, in this case iron, all the way to a finished product like a house or another structure.
The amount of cement used for construction is unimaginably large. Just think of one landing strip at 8 inches. Mm. That's a tremendous amount of cement. What kind of coverage could you reasonably envision with ferroc?
It's important to remember that it's taken a couple of hundred years for the modern Portland cement industry to fully develop. Whole mountain ranges of limestone have been mined out in order to satisfy this great demand. We would be up against that high volume, especially at this early stage, in producing enough ferroc to do these giant projects. But that's part of the challenge. Perhaps in 200 years, hopefully far less, ferroc would be produced at that kind of volume. There's certainly enough iron on the planet to satisfy any and all demands for an iron-based cement like ferroc.
It's mostly iron, is my understanding.
Yes, it's mostly iron. We also add other ingredients, fly ash, for instance, from coal-burning power plants, as a silica source, in addition to the silica of the glass. That's another category of ingredient, silica, which is a slow reaction, but it's also very important.
Is ferroc a better insulation material than cement is?
Well, of course, insulation depends a lot on density. Foam is very insulative because it is so light and not dense and prevents heat from traveling through it. Ferroc can be quite dense and heat would travel through it very well, but if you made the wall thick enough, as in, say, a rammed earth type wall, the very thickness of it prevents the heat from traveling through efficiently. But ferroc can also be made very light. In fact, foamy. And in that case, all the trapped air or trapped CO2 gas can make it quite insulative.
You would use the CO2 to make it bubbly, just like a Coke.
Yes, there are various forms of aerated cement. Autoclaved aerated cement is becoming very popular in Europe. It's starting to be used in the United States. They use aluminum powder. In reaction with the cement creates hydrogen gas, lots of little bubbles, foams it up. We wouldn't use that. We would use CO2. We would bubble it up with CO2 and trap the gas physically as well as chemically in that mix.
How would you compare the tensile strength of Portland cement with ferroc?
Ferroc has a much higher tensile strength. Flexural strength, for instance, was recently tested, which is a combination of compressive strength and tensile strength. A slab, when it bends, is both crushed and pulled apart at the same time on opposite sides. And ferroc was determined to have almost 5 times the flexural strength of Portland cement. It could take a lot more stress before bending, as well as it would take a lot more before breaking.
Let's get back to the Tohono aspect of it. You were invited by the community college to teach the students about sustainability on the basis of your invention. And what happened then?
The first lesson to be learned was that recycling does not mean you put a glass bottle or a plastic bottle or a piece of cardboard in a bin, walk away, and forget about it. That is not the recycling. That's the start of the recycling process. Real recycling means actually utilizing those waste materials in something useful. useful that will be used again. And that was something the students didn't quite realize. And it's something that the whole country and society needs to do more of, to recycle locally rather than ship it out to China, which is one of the biggest buyers of recycled materials. They know how to utilize it, but in the United States, we're not as advanced yet in recycling. That's lesson number one, to use the materials that are generated locally, the waste materials, and put them to other functions and in other applications. The glass that was being collected on the nation was going 65 miles to the Los Reales landfill, and the nation was being charged $32 tipping fee, as they call it, to dump it there. Our recycling avoided those kinds of costs, both of transporting it and dumping it in the landfill and using it right on the spot. So it was local recycling using a material that had come in from the outside and now would be utilized permanently in all of these products, blocks, pavers, and now little buildings.
And what happened next?
I next got hooked up with Richard Pablo, who is a Tohono O'odham man looking for something to do in a sustainable way. And Richard, of course, can speak for himself on this, but so began an 8-year collaboration between myself and Richard. Richard was able to teach me about the culture and about all the ways of interacting properly and respectfully with the culture and the people of that culture, the Tohono O'odham, which means desert people in their own language. They were formerly known as the Papago. Richard and I began this partnership where I would teach him about what I knew in chemistry, environmental science, technology, and he was able then to incorporate that information in a cultural way, in a O'odham way, and integrate it with the people and the community there. And that was very, very helpful because on my own, I would not have gotten far. With Richard as my guide, we were able to open up the communities and the people to helping us. And once they knew what we were doing, they would show us sites that had been deposited with bottles, sometimes over decades. We came to places where there was fields of glass. You could not see the desert ground in between the saguaros. There was tens of thousands of bottles that had accumulated over time.
How did they get there?
Those bottles were thrown there by people who had been drinking from them. The nation is supposed to be dry. Drinking is not allowed. Alcohol is not sold. However, people who drank anyway would go out to these so-called party sites along the roads out in the desert. Some of these sites had been used for many years, even decades. And over all those years, the empty bottles accumulated because they were just tossed. They were open-air bars, so to speak. And it was time for us to clean them up. Because as Richard Pablo said, those bottles are teachers. They teach the young people the wrong lesson, that it's okay to drink, is okay to discard waste into the desert. He was able to do several things at once, talk about picking up those bottles to others who had been drinking and get them to do their part to clean up the desert. We had one woman come out with us who said, "I can't believe I'm here." She stood up suddenly with two bottles, one in each hand, and said, "I can't believe I'm here. I was at this same site 27 years ago, and some of these bottles are my own bottles from which I drank and tossed them. Now I'm out here picking them up." Everyone should come out and pick up their own bottles and return them to this recycling process and make something good come of them, something useful. And others, through those kinds of statements and expressions of personal commitment, joined us. And sometimes we had dozens of people just making short work of these ancient garbage sites and cleaning them up. We've been very surprised, Richard and I. We've gone out to sites that had bottles for as long as anyone can remember, all their lives. And now it is completely clean. There's no bottle to be seen.
Richard Pablo was already collecting bottles before you met him?
No, he wasn't. This was something new to him. That was my contribution, to say that these bottles can be used and recycled in this way. That's where the chemistry came in. Glass, beer bottles or window glass, is silica, an amorphous silica, which means it's non-crystalline. And because it's non-crystalline, it's more reactive. That much I knew from the chemistry lab. For me, the bottles represented a free and readily accessible source of silica. For Richard, they represented something quite different. They were monuments to the drinking and to the historical trauma that he and his people had suffered. And this was one way in which it became manifest, through self-medication, as they say, through drinking. He took it upon himself to try to reverse that process. Richard made of recycling a kind of ritual, a cleansing ritual, both for the individual and for the desert. And as the individual people who had maybe once thrown bottles in these sites cleaned the land of these bottles, they often remarked on how it helped purify them and made them feel better as people, doing something in such a positive way.
You and Richard came from very opposite sides of the human spectrum. How was it to collaborate with him?
Well, some of us have called Richard and myself an odd couple. Odd but complementary. As I said, he was able to translate the environmental science that I brought to the project into cultural concepts that everyone there could understand. Recycling is kind of an abstract term that doesn't mean much to most people other than putting some waste material in a bin. But for Richard, it became a way to reconnect with the land and make an act of sacrifice, your time, your energy, your effort, and your thoughts to this greater good. That was right in keeping with the autumn cultural mindset, of which I knew nothing. He was able to teach me about that aspect. And so the technology and the culture became fused and wedded together in a way that made more sense to both sides, because people have always been pushing for recycling. As some environmental scientists have said, it's a hard sell because it's so boring. Recycling is boring. With Richard Pablo, it became anything but boring. It became a sacred act, a ritualistic act of cleaning the desert. And then to see that residue of drinking, which itself is a result of intergenerational trauma, turn into something useful. For example, right now we are making what they call an oras ki, which is roundhouse in the autumn language. Ki is house, oras is round. This is an ancient architectural structure, 1,000 years old. Pit house is what the anthropologists call it. We are now recreating that kind of architecture once again after 1,000 years, but using these modern materials, waste iron, broken glass, global warming greenhouse gases like CO2. Combining all these modern materials in a green environmental way, but using an ancient architectural tradition as the form that it takes.
Thank you very much, David.
You're welcome.
And I hope this expands to the same range as the cement industry.
Well, it would be an odd thing and ironic if, for once, the Native American cultures could export something rather than import so much from the dominant culture. We would like to export not only the material technology, but also the cultural attitude that perhaps must go with it to really take root elsewhere.
You told me that every bottle Richard picks up is a prayer to him.
For him, picking up the bottle is a little bit like picking up a Bible or a sacred object, because it represents for him loss and failure, which must be made sacred in order to be undone. First, you must make the pain and the suffering also meaningful in some cultural way, and then you can move on from there to recapturing the more positive ancient traditions of living close to the land, being self-sufficient, all the lessons that our culture and all cultures will need to learn in the coming years as we deal with global warming and other massive environmental challenges.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you, Dan.